Hello and welcome to The Stooshie, the Scottish politics podcast from DC Thompson that helps you be better briefed. I'm Adele Merson, and on this week's episode, we're taking a close look at a long-running plea for justice in the north of Scotland, being described as similar in scale to the post office scandal. At its heart are the dozens of families devastated by con man Alistair Gregg. The 70-year-old was a respected financial advisor based in Aberdeen who ended up duping 184 victims out of £13 million. Now they want justice. To tell the story, I'm joined by Dale Haslam, an investigations reporter with the Press and Journal newspaper. Welcome to The Stooshie.
Thanks, Adele. It's nice to be here.
So, Dale, take me back to where this all began.
Okay, so to explain this story, we need to rewind to September 2014 to a small office on Little Belmont Street, which is just off Union Street in Aberdeen city centre. Many listeners will know it as a relatively quiet area that's full of shops and bars and restaurants. But on this particular day, it was far from quiet. There was a dozen or so staff at Midas Finance Solutions Scotland. They were hard at work in the office when all of a sudden a team of investigators burst through the door with a court summons in hand. The entire office was shut down. All the paperwork was seized and all the staff were ordered to go home. This was the FCA's fraud team, that the Financial Conduct Authority. They were looking into a massive £13 million fraud.
It sounds quite a shocking sequence of events. Was this raid a surprise to the Midas staff?
To most of them, yeah. It was very shocking, though a few of them knew the writing was on the wall, as they themselves had turned whistleblower once they had got a sense of what was going on at Midas. And there was only really one man at fault, and that was Alistair Gregg. Absolutely none of his colleagues had done anything illegal. They were stunned at his industrial scale scam.
It all sounds quite crazy. What was it all about?
Well, the Financial Conduct Authority had been given a tip that Alistair Gregg was a scammer. He was registered with them to sell financial services like mortgages and pensions and investment products. So, for example, people might invest, say, £100,000 in Midas and then get the money back a year later with, say, 7% interest. But it turned out that all the while, Gregg was not investing that money in the way he said. In fact, he was just putting it in his own pocket. And when people did come to cash out, he simply gave them someone else's money.
That sounds like a Ponzi scheme to me, where a scammer pays out old investors with the funds from new investors. Is that what was happening?
Yes. And it had been going on for 7 years, since 2007. In total, there were 184 victims, and they were all Northeast families. And we're not talking rich people. We're talking fishermen, farmers, builders, just normal families who had saved all their lives and tried to invest for their retirements. Some of the victims put in figures of up to £400,000 each. For years, they'd been told that their money was safe within Midas and was building interest. Alistair Gregg assured them that he had an arrangement with the Royal Bank of Scotland, but that was a lie.
Where did the £13 million go, and what happened to Alistair Gregg?
He had been channeling his clients' money into his own personal slush fund, and he used it to fund a champagne lifestyle. He would jet away on holiday and take dozens of his pals along and pay for them. And Gregg would also get wined and dined in VIP boxes at some of the most exclusive sporting events like Royal Ascot and the British Grand Prix. He even used his victims' money to fund his own classic cars business. When it all came crashing down, Alistair Gregg was arrested, he was charged, and he appeared in court for a trial in Edinburgh. And incredibly, he only had £814 left to repay to the courts out of the £13 million that he stole. He was found guilty and he's now serving a 10-year jail sentence. Police told us that they were so overwhelmed by the number of victims that they had to rope in their back office staff to help them with the case. And detectives also had to send a newsletter out to the victims. Such was the enormous task of keeping them up to date. So Alistair Gregg went to jail, but these 184 people were still £13 million out of pocket. And so from then on, they formed a plan.
It sounds like those families who'd fallen victim to Gregg were really up against it at this point. What did they do?
Well, 95 of those 184 victims banded together and they formed a campaign group. Each of the 95 put in an initial £5,000 and they instructed lawyers to fight for them. And that led to several legal cases which were heard in the civil courts. One of the court hearings was in London and the victims told me it was an odd experience for them because they won and lost at the same time.
How do you mean?
Well, the hearing was supposed to establish if the victims should get compensation, and that bid failed. But during the hearing, The judge classified the crime as an investment fraud, and that made all the difference. Because that classification meant that Alistair Gregg's victims would get some of their money back.
What did they get, and how did that work?
Well, there's a body called the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. It's a fund that businesses pay into. So say you invest in a company that is registered with the FCA and it fails, you can get a compensation. But there's a problem. The maximum amount the Financial Services Compensation Scheme pays out is £85,000 per person. So in the case of Alistair Gregg's victims, they only got back a fraction of what they lost.
And I would imagine that 95 of those victims, the ones that actually took the civil action, are even worse off.
Yeah, that's right. Because in total, it cost those 95 people just shy of a total of 2 million in legal costs. So those 95 people are down hundreds of thousands of pounds each. And as you can imagine, it's had a massive effect on those people's lives. Some of those affected have sadly since died. We've heard that a number of them have suffered strokes, heart attacks. And this stress has been directly linked to the suffering that Alistair Gregg instilled on them. Others have had to delay their retirement because they've lost their pension pots, and many have had their life savings decimated. And the worst part is that all this could have been avoided. Alistair Gregg could have been stopped in his tracks.
Interesting. How do you mean?
Well, in 2008, Alistair Gregg filled out a form and he stated that he was registered to do something with his company, but it was a lie. In fact, Alistair Gregg had been banned from performing that particular task after he'd been suspected of mortgage fraud, but nobody looked into it. Someone pointed this inconsistency out to the Financial Services Authority in 2012, but it didn't act. And also in 2012, another whistleblower emailed the Financial Services Authority to warn them about Gregg's fraud. And the FSA sent the email to the wrong department and they never followed it up.
So there were three missed chances to stop Gregg at least 2 years before his office was raided.
Yes. And had the regulators acted back in 2008, there would have only been one victim by then. And so 183 Northeast families would have not lost £13 million. And it's worth saying that the Financial Services Authority is no longer in existence. It was replaced in 2013 by the Financial Conduct Authority, which is why the campaigners and the victims are so mad at the FCA today.
And what do the victims make of these three missed opportunities?
Well, they asked an independent watchdog to look into what the FSA had done. And that watchdog's comments were scathing. This was the Financial Regulators Complaints Commissioner, whose name is Anthony Townsend. He said that two of the errors were as a result of a deliberate decision by the FSA not to investigate, and he described these errors as significant. Mr. Townsend was so moved by the FSA's errors that he ordered its successor organisation, the FCA, to write to Alistair Gregg's victims to apologise for their shortcomings. The FCA did that, but to this day, it refuses to stump up any compensation. And that's because, as a regulator, it doesn't legally have to do so.
So where does that leave the victims?
The victims are sadly still out of pocket and are still awaiting justice. For years now, they've been told, well, nothing can be done. This is the way the system is. But people said that about the post office victims too. Some may recall that some of those post office victims were sent to jail and they were treated horribly by the post office and by the state. And that was until pressure eventually cracked and lo and behold, the Prime Minister changed everything for those victims. Alistair Gregg's victims believe that this is the Northeast's version of the post office scandal, and so things should change for them too.
So what's the latest development?
Shetland and Orkney MP Alistair Carmichael has been fighting on behalf of Alistair Gregg's victims for years. Last Wednesday night, he organised an event at the House of Commons. At the event, he showed a video which illustrated Alistair Gregg's crimes and also the FCA's shortcomings. And he invited the FCA to attend so they could watch it. The families of those who were conned by Alistair Gregg also wanted us at the Press and Journal to attend the event. So I went down to London and sat there with the Shetland and Orkney MP in his party office at Portcullis House, which overlooks Westminster Bridge. I asked Alistair Carmichael what motivated him to organise the event.
I think, first of all, it's about accountability. If I were to sort of look at this objectively, I could probably say, look, you've put in a shift here, you've had debates in Parliament, you've got to the point where people have had some compensation, not full compensation, but, you know, people are much better off than they would have been otherwise. And a few of the people who've been involved have been very kind and saying, well, you know, you've sort of fought our case and we're grateful. I can't just walk away from this still. It's not going to be the end of the story. Because unless and until the Financial Conduct Authority, the chief executive of whom, incidentally, is paid £455,000 of taxpayers' money a year, unless and until they live up to the responsibilities that Parliament gave them. And I mean that the purpose of their creation, not the detail of every individual scheme, then I think, you know, I can't just walk away from this. If I did, what would be the point of being a Member of Parliament? I think it must now be about 8 years. I think it would be back to about 2016 when I was first contacted by a constituent. And, you know, within minutes of talking to him, I realised actually this is not just one person. This is a whole range of local people in Shetland. And the more you dug into it, you realised actually it went right down through mainland Scotland. And if you wanted to map the sort of progression of fishing communities in Scotland and then overlay it with the victims of the Midas scandal, you would do you would see a pretty big overlap. So, you know, from Shetland into Orkney, along the Murray coast there, so Banff, along into Peterhead, Fraserburgh, down the east coast, through Aberdeen, into Angus, and some of the communities around there. There were other people in other parts of the country. That was predominantly where the victims of this lay. And, you know, from many ways, it was one of those occasions where you saw a loose thread and you pulled it, and it kept coming and coming and coming. And, you know, sometimes it's about a personal connection. And right from the start, I kind of felt that the people who were losing out here were people that I knew all over Shetland. And, you know, they weren't people who had traded up millions by flipping houses or doing clever deals in the city. This was people who had worked hard all their lives, put away a few thousand here, a few thousand there. And also, because I had, when I'd been in legal practice, the area where I had worked had been along that Murray coast from Banffshire into Aberdeenshire. I just kind of knew the people who were involved, and I just thought, you know, we can't give up on these people.
So you mentioned 2016. Yeah. Prior to that, for 20, 30 years, the man at the centre of this, Alistair Gregg,
yeah,
he spent that time building up pretty much a first-class professional reputation, yeah, as a financial advisor. I think for most people, that's what's so shocking about this, that he's not a scammer from the other side, yeah, of the world. He was a man who built up this trust, which he then abused.
That is where you have to understand the nature of the communities that we're talking about here. I've been the Member of Parliament for Orkney and Shetland since 2001, so that's coming on for 23 years. And before that, I lived and worked in Aberdeenshire. I was in legal practice there. And if you understand these communities, then you understand that actually a lot of store is put in personal reputation and family connections and all the rest of it. It maybe sounds a little bit unworldly sitting here in the heart of Westminster, but, you know, these people did trust Gregg, and that trust was betrayed in a quite colossal and catastrophic manner. And, you know, he's got his time in prison now as a consequence of that. But they're left picking up the pieces. Just about everybody is still talking about Mr. Bates versus the Post Office and the Horizon scandal, which has caught the public imagination. But, you know, the truth of the matter is that the Horizon scandal is just one public body. And this is another public body, the Financial Conduct Authority, that have treated people in the same way. You know, they have stonewalled, they've straight-batted, they go out and they find the best cases in the biggest, flashiest city firms of solicitors. And there's no equality of arms here. So, you know, it was an act of quite incredible tenacity on the part of the victims of Alistair Greig to go as far as they did, and as you know, with the amount of force that they did. And I have no doubt that had these 95 claimants not taken the legal action that they did, then the FCA would never have paid a penny to anyone.
Because when we look back at the history of this case, we're talking about 180 people, give or take, losing a total of 13 million. Yeah. But initially, they didn't stand to get a penny back. And it was only because the 95 claimants you mentioned took it upon themselves to launch civil proceedings. And again, here in London, they finally, albeit they lost in terms of what they were trying to achieve, but the fact that the mechanism, if you like, was deemed to be an investment, paved the way for all 180 people to get their £85,000 back, which was obviously a big positive step. However, it still left those 95 people £2 million out of pocket. What do you think about that as we stand here today?
I think it is just about the shoddiest way that any public body can behave. You know, why do we have a financial conduct authority? It's supposed to be there to ensure that anybody who is coming in off the street with no financial expertise, getting advice about what to do with their money, can do so with some confidence because you're dealing with people who are regulated. So that's a real duty of trust there. The culture within that organisation and its predecessor is completely wrong, bluntly. Now, for those who were the 95 brave souls who kept fighting and who took the matter to court, they're left with £2 million, or very nearly, out of pocket. And there seems to be no recognition of the responsibility of FCA in that money being left as their liability. And I had a conversation with the FCA on Friday night. Their director of something or another and their head of parliamentary engagement, and they had written to me saying, "Well, we're not going to come to your screening of the documentary." We've had our final word on this because they want this to go away, just like the post office used to want it to go away. And I eventually put to them a fairly straightforward question, which was to say, how much would anybody have got if these 95 claimants had not done what they did? And the silence was deafening. Eventually, I couldn't hold her any longer. I said, well, I think I can see why you don't want to come on Wednesday. So it's that element of accountability
and from a public body. The FCA say that change has been made, that this was many years ago, that the systems have been updated. What strikes me is that these were very basic mistakes. Yeah. For our listeners, it's not anything cross wires or it isn't anything that's, that is something that a professional detail. We're talking about phone calls not being sent to the right department and not being followed up.
Yeah.
We're talking about a whistleblower going to them to say, I am providing you evidence that Alistair Greig has lied. This is actionable. You should stop him doing what he's doing. And they did nothing because perhaps it was a Pandora's box at that stage. But the heart of the matter is that at that stage, had they have taken the action that they should have, only one of the 180 or so victims would have fallen victim. And this has all been backed up, observed by the independent ombudsman. This isn't the campaigners saying it. Given that, do you think that there is perhaps a lack of professional pride from the SA in terms of, we've made a mistake, we want to improve, we want to make sure this doesn't happen again? And the fact that they're not sending someone to this screening and the correspondence that you've described indicates that complacency.
The quite remarkable situation that we have tonight in the House of Commons, and the FCA, the publicly funded body, are not prepared to come along and account. You know, it's the classic case that if you've got nothing to hide, you should have nothing to fear.
And I mean, to bolster that point about the attendees at this screening tonight, we also have the wife of Alistair Gregg himself, Judy Gregg, who some of our listeners may think, well, why is she here? And the reason why is because in the months after Alistair Gregg's very elaborate scheme kind of fell, came crashing to the ground, she didn't know what was going on. I think that's been accepted by everybody. And she helped the victims by giving them various assistance, which helped them again with their campaign later on. Do you think that that speaks volumes, the fact that Judy Gregg is going to be here?
I think it absolutely does. And, you know, you can only imagine how difficult it must have been for her at the time. The victims of Alistair Gregg are spread far and wide, and it's not just those who lost money. I think the fact that she's done what she has done in terms of helping the victims and that she's coming along today speaks incredibly well to her strength of character. And I just wish that that strength of character could be found amongst the senior officers of the FCA.
That was Shetland and Orkney MP Alistair Carmichael. So we know the FCA didn't send anyone to Wednesday's event, which took place at the Palace of Westminster. Who did attend?
Gordon MP Richard Thompson attended, as did Angus MP Dave Dugan. Also in attendance was Colin Stewart, whose parents, Mabel and Jimmy, who live in Portlethen, also fell victim to Alistair Gregg's crimes, and they lost out on tens of thousands of pounds, if not more. Colin was the man who organised the group of 95 victims who took the civil action. I spoke to Colin at Westminster after the event, and I must apologise for the bit of background noise that you will hear towards the end of this interview.
Colin, we're here in a committee room at the House of Commons. Alistair Carmichael, Shetland and Orkney MP, kindly arranged to have this documentary, which profiles the Midas case, shown here for the good of other MPs and other interested parties. What do you think, firstly, about the fact that this video is being shown here and how that highlights the ongoing campaign for justice for the Midas victims?
I think it's very important that we continue to keep this up in the limelight, because unless we get this sorted, there's going to be more victims. Because the FCA is immune from prosecution for negligence, we're going to have this problem. I'm not trying to sue them. I'm just asking them to do the right thing and to pay the cost that we incurred due to their mistakes.
With the post office scandal, you know, going back maybe even 2 years, people thought the same about that. And yet here we've seen that political will, which has overturned convictions, which has paved the way for compensation to be paid. Does that show that all that's missing here is the political will?
Well, and doesn't it show that nothing gets done unless the public stand up and make the people in power accountable? So why should it be like this? For example, my parents, they paid £61,000 costs for a legal case that we wouldn't have had to take had the FCA done the job and listened to the whistleblowers in the first place.
And I've personally this week spoken to two of those victims, and even after all these years, it's still, you know, they feel embarrassed, they feel hurt by it. Do you think if the FCA does the decent thing and, you know, builds on its apology, compensates the 95 people you've mentioned properly, that it would help them move on to some extent?
It will help them feel a bit more justified. I don't think they'll ever get over what happened. It was hugely devastating. But getting that money back will at least put them on an equal par with the people who weren't in the group, who didn't have to pay the costs.
Colin Stewart there. After the event, Dale also caught up with Gordon MP Richard Thompson.
I think the thing I found most striking about it was just how shocking it was. That here was somebody who had been removed from a mortgage panel for dishonesty, that had been engaging in some financial transactions that you think ought to have been bringing about suspicion. And then also when finally an investigation was initiated at the FCA, that the ball was dropped entirely within the organisation. So, you know, there were at least those three opportunities to stop things, and it didn't happen. The families who have been affected have been failed terribly of the regulatory environment that ought to be there to protect them.
And we've seen that in this screening tonight, that, you know, the points you make are very crystallised in terms of not only the FCA's failings, but the Ombudsman making it crystal clear that the FCA should have intervened, and that had they have done so at that stage, there was only one victim of the 180 or so that ended up. So all those would have been spared the emotional and financial trauma, inconvenience, what, call it what you want. Do you think that, given the fact that the Ombudsman has compelled the FCA to apologise in writing to the victims, that it's now duty bound to pay them back the £2 million it, some would say, it owes them?
Well, I would argue yes, there's a moral responsibility. There may not be a legal responsibility, but it's pretty clear that there's a moral responsibility. And it seems to me that, you know, from having been compelled to apologise by the Ombudsman, it's almost like a sulky teenager that's been dragged by its parents to, you know, apologise for what it's done. But to accept no further liability beyond that, I think, is unacceptable, frankly. 95 of those who were affected by this fraud had to embark on their own legal action in order to even drag the FCA to that position. So they've notionally had their £85,000, but they've also had to absorb the legal costs on top of that. So they, in many ways, although they've opened the gateway to that minimum level of compensation for others, they have found themselves suffering financially. That £85,000 threshold is because it's not the job of the FCA to bail out failing institutions. But when that failing institution is the FCA itself, I think to hide behind that is quite shameful. I think the comparison with Horizon is a very good one. I would widen that out to the WASPI campaign.
Yeah, that's a good example.
As well, where, again, another Ombudsman has decided to throw this issue back to Parliament because they say they can't really trust and be confident that the government will do the right thing by them. So it's been left to parliamentarians to pick up the pieces and play it from there. But I think that there's clearly the FCA are behaving in such a way that they hope this will just go away. They hope that people will decide that eventually the victims will decide that they want to get on with their lives and they'll forget it, or that members of Parliament will lose interest. But I think there's a fundamental point here that, you know, Parliament, whatever you think of this place at Westminster, you know, it should always be there to do the right thing. And I don't know when we stopped being a place that did the right thing, you know, when there is a clear corporate failing like that. And just because this is an arm's length regulator set up by government, I don't think that should let the FCA off the hook here, because there were a number of opportunities where this could have been stopped, where we could have ended up in a situation where it was nipped in the bud and there were no victims at all. Instead of that, we're now in the situation that we're in. And really, even just arguing for those legal expenses to be refunded that were incurred so many years ago, that's really quite a modest ask, I would say. And really, if there was an ounce of integrity in the system, we'd be looking at the victims not only being recompensed to that extent, but because of the very specific failings of the FCA itself, rather than other institutions per se, because of those very specific feelings, I think there's a very strong case to argue that the FCA should be looking for full restitution in respect of the monies that have been lost.
I've spoken to two victims this week that have never told their story before. The trauma of the loss of money and the things that have happened in their lives as a result of that, but also the fight for justice, it's worn them down, and they see tonight, both of the families and a lot that I've spoken to and a lot more victims see tonight as the last chance. But perhaps for me, one of the most constructive things that's come out of the screening tonight was the discussion that's been had, and albeit without any firm commitment, about the options that might be there to take it forward. Are you confident that at least the fight for compensation and justice isn't dead, that it can carry on because of this political will in the room tonight?
Well, yes, it can certainly carry on. I mean, the difficulty is it's hard to compel the FCA to do the right thing. But what we can do is continue to highlight the issue. This will not by any means be the only case across the British Isles where people feel that they've been let down by that particular regulator. So there are opportunities, I think, to discuss, to bring this into the open, because obviously Midas was predominantly an issue affecting the northeast of Scotland, which makes it all the more pernicious in many ways because of the word of mouth and the nature of the marketing that went on and the sheer abuse of trust amongst those, you know, that was perpetrated on those who entrusted their savings with this particular individual. So I think that there's there's opportunities to highlight this injustice and perhaps bring other injustices to the fore here in terms of discussing the fitness for purpose in many respects. Maybe not of the FCA as an institution, because you always need a financial regulator, whatever it's called and however it's badged. But in terms of the fitness of purpose of the approach that they've adopted here, because, as I say, that £85,000 cap is there for a reason. The FCA is not there to protect the reckless or the greedy, but nobody here was reckless or greedy. People invested in good faith and were let down, yes, by one individual, but also by the failed regulatory environment that the FCA ultimately had a responsibility for. And they should have been wise to what was going on. They had opportunities to pick it up. Even when it was really flagged to them, they failed when they tried to, one department of the FCA thought another should investigate it, and it never made it from one side of the building to the other. So I think there is an enhanced level of culpability here with the FCA. And I think there are opportunities to shine a light on that further.
Gordon MP Richard Thompson talking at the House of Commons to our Impact Investigations reporter Dale Haslam. It's interesting that Richard Thompson was saying there that he believes the fight for compensation isn't over. What more can be done?
Some of the victims I've spoken to recently believe that this event at the House of Commons was their last chance for justice. But the fighting spirit at that London event was strong. The MPs present agreed to see if they can raise the matter further at Westminster and also at Holyrood, and perhaps take it to a committee in which they can compel someone senior from the FCA to attend to explain themselves. In fact, Alistair Carmichael raised the issue during a debate at the House of Commons on Thursday about victims' access to redress. He acknowledged during that debate the work that we at the Press and Journal have done to expose the regulators' failings and to support Alistair Gregg's victims. The MP said during his speech that the FCA had been poor at doing their job. It's fair to say this fight will keep on going, and we'll be there to cover it along the way. We had prominent coverage in Monday's Evening Express and the Press and Journal, and also on the Press and Journal website, including new accounts from victims.
Finally, what have the FCA said about all this?
I contacted the FCA, whose spokesman provided me with a statement, and that statement reads, "We understand the distress suffered by those caught up in the fraudulent actions of Alistair Gregg. We have apologised to those affected by the fraud for the fact that our predecessor organisation did not act more quickly at the time, and we have worked to recover money for investors. The case has been considered by the Financial Regulators Complaints Commissioner, who determined that it would not be appropriate for the FCA to pay any form of compensation, and it would not be appropriate for us to cover the legal fees for a case we were not directly involved in. We appreciate that this may be frustrating for investors. We take our accountability to Parliament seriously, but in this instance, we have clearly set out our final position."
Thanks, Dale, for giving us an insight into this fascinating story.
Thanks, Adele.
And if you want to know more about these shocking crimes, go to the P&J investigation section on the Press and Journal website, where you will find a 6-part series called King of the Swindlers. Thank you for listening to this week's Douchey podcast from DC Thompson. We'll be back next week for more. Until then, subscribe to the Press and Journal, The Courier, and all of our news brands so that you can be better briefed.